Chapter 125. The thunderbolt, the barrier between Mr. Domini and his wife was not weakened by time. Ill-assorted couple, unhappy in themselves and in each other, bound together by no tie, but the manacle that joined their fettered hands, and straining that so harshly, in their shrinking asunder, that it wore and chafed to the bone, time, consoler of affliction and softener of anger, could do nothing to help them. Their pride, however different in kind and object, was equal in degree, and, in their flinty opposition, struck out fire between them which might smolder or might blaze, as circumstances were, but burned up everything within their mutual reach, and made their marriage way a road of ashes. Let us be just to him. In the monstrous delusion of his life, swelling with every grain of sand that shifted in its glass, he urged her on, he little thought to what, or considered how, but still his feeling towards her, such as it was, remained as at first. She had the grand merit of unaccountably putting herself in opposition to the recognition of his vast importance, and to the acknowledgement of her complete submission to it, and so far it was necessary to correct and reduce her, but otherwise he still considered her, in his cold way, a lady capable of doing honor, if she would, to his choice and name, and of reflecting credit on his proprietorship. Now, she, with all her might of passionate and proud resentment, bent her dark glance from day to day, and hour to hour from that night, in her own chamber, when she had sat gazing at the shadows on the wall, to the deeper night fast coming upon one figure directing a crowd of humiliations and exasperations against her, and that figure, still her husband's. Was Mr. Domini's master vice, that ruled him so inexorably, an unnatural characteristic? It might be worthwhile, sometimes, to inquire what nature is, and how men work to change her, and whether, in the enforced distortion so produced, it is not natural to be unnatural. Coop any son or daughter of our mighty mother within narrow range, and bind the prisoner to one idea, and foster it by servile worship of it on the part of the few timid or designing people standing round, and what is nature to the willing captive who has never risen up upon the wings of a free mind drooping and useless soon, to see her in her comprehensive truth? Alas, are there so few things in the world, about us, most unnatural, and yet most natural in being so? Hear the magistrate or judge admonish the unnatural outcasts of society, unnatural in brutal habits, unnatural in want of decency, unnatural in losing and confounding all distinctions between good and evil, unnatural in ignorance, in vice, in recklessness, in contumacy, in mind, in looks, in everything. But follow the good clergyman or doctor, who, with his life imperiled at every breath he draws, goes down into their dens, lying within the echoes of our carriage wheels, and daily tread upon the pavement stones. Look round upon the world of odious sights. Millions of immortal creatures have no other world on earth at the lightest mention of which humanity revolts, and dainty delicacy living in the next street stops her ears, and lists, I don't believe it. Apostrophe, apostrophe, breathe the polluted air, foul with every impurity that is poisonous to health and life, and have every sense, conferred upon our race for its delight and happiness, offended, sickened, and disgusted, and made a channel by which misery and death alone can enter. Vainly attempt to think of any simple plant, or flower, or wholesome weed, that, set in this fetid bed, could have its natural growth, or put its little leaves off to the sun as God designed it. And then, calling up some ghastly child, with stunted form and wicked face, hold forth on its unnatural sinfulness, and lament its being, so early, far away from heaven, but think a little of its having been conceived, and born and bred, in hell. Those who study the physical sciences, and bring them to bear upon the health of man, tell us that, if the noxious particles, that rise from vitiated air, were palpable to the sight, we should see them lowering in a dense black cloud above such haunts, and rolling slowly on to corrupt the better portions of a town. But if the moral pestilence, that rises with them, and in the eternal laws of our nature, is inseparable from them, could be made discernible to, how terrible the revelation! Then should we see depravity, impiety, drunkenness, theft, murder, and a long train of nameless sins against the natural affections and repulsions of mankind, overhanging the devoted spots, and creeping on, to blight the innocent and spread contagion among the pure. Then should we see how the same poisoned fountains that flow into our hospitals and lazar houses, inundate the jails, and make the convict ships swim deep, and roll across the seas, and overrun vast continents with crime. Then should we stand appalled to know, that where we generate disease, to strike our children down, and entail itself on unborn generations, there also we breed, by the same certain process, infancy that knows no innocence, youth without modesty or shame, maturity that is mature in nothing but in suffering and guilt, blasted old age, that is a scandal on the form we bear, a natural humanity. When we shall gather grapes from thorns, and figs from thistles, when fields of grain shall spring up from the offal in the byways of our wicked cities, and roses bloom in the fat churchyards that they cherish, then we may look for natural humanity, and find it growing from such seed. Oh, for a good spirit who would take the housetops off, with a more potent and benignant hand than the lame demon in the tale, and show a Christian people what dark shapes issue from amidst their homes, to swell the retinue of the destroying angel as he moves forth among them. For only one night's view of the pale phantoms rising from the scenes of our too long neglect, and from the thick and sullen air where vice and fever propagate together, raining the tremendous social retributions which are ever pouring down, and ever coming thicker. Bright and blessed the morning that should rise on such a night. For men, delayed no more by stumbling blocks of their own making, which are but specks of dust upon the path between them and eternity, would then apply themselves, like creatures of one common origin, owing one duty to the father of one family, and tending to one common end, to make the world a better place. Not the less bright and blessed would that day be for arousing some who never have looked out upon the world of human life around them, to a knowledge of their own relation to it, and for making them acquainted with a perversion of nature in their own contracted sympathies and estimates, as great, and yet as natural in its development when once begun, as the lowest degradation known. But no such day had ever dawned on Mr. Dombey, or his wife, and the course of each was taken. Through 6 months that ensued upon his accident, they held the same relations one towards the other. A marble rock could not have stood more obdurately in his way than she, and no chilled spring, lying uncheered by any ray of light in the depths of a deep cave, could be more sullen or more cold than he. The hope that had fluttered within her when the promise of her new home dawned was quite gone from the heart of Florence now. That home was nearly 2 years old, and even the patient trust that was in her could not survive the daily blight of such experience. If she had any lingering fancy in the nature of hope left, that Edith and her father might be happier together in some distant time, she had none now that her father would ever love her. The little interval in which she had imagined that she saw some small relenting in him was forgotten in the long remembrance of his coldness since and before, or only remembered as a sorrowful delusion. Florence loved him still, but, by degrees, had come to love him rather as some dear one who had been, or who might have been, than as the hard reality before her eyes. Something of the softened sadness with which she loved the memory of little Paul, or of her mother, seemed to enter now into her thoughts of him, and to make them, as it were, a dear remembrance. Whether it was that he was dead to her, and that partly for this reason, partly for his share in those old objects of her affection, and partly for the long association of him with hopes that were withered, and tendernesses he had frozen, she could not have told. But the father whom she loved began to be a vague and dreamy idea to her, hardly more substantially connected with her real life than the image she would sometimes conjure up, of her dear brother yet alive, and growing to be a man, who would protect and cherish her. The change, if it may be called one, had stolen on her like a change from childhood to womanhood, and had come with it. Florence was almost 17, when, in her lonely musings, she was conscious of these thoughts. Apostrophe, she was often alone now, for the old association between her and her mama was greatly changed. At the time of her father's accident, and when he was lying in his room downstairs, Florence had first observed that Edith avoided her. Wounded and shocked, and yet unable to reconcile this with her affection when they did meet, she sought her in her own room at night, once more. Mama, apostrophe said Florence, stealing softly to her side, have I offended you? Apostrophe, Edith answered no. Apostrophe, I must have done something, apostrophe said Florence. Tell me what it is. You have changed your manner to me, dear mama. I cannot say how instantly I feel the least change, for I love you with my whole heart. Apostrophe, as I do you, apostrophe said Edith. Ah, Florence, believe me never more than now. Apostrophe, why do you go away from me so often, and keep away? Apostrophe asked Florence. And why do you sometimes look so strangely on me, dear mama? You do so, do you not? Apostrophe, Edith signified assent with her dark eyes. Why? Apostrophe returned Florence imploringly. Tell me why, that I may know how to please you better, and tell me this shall not be so any more. My Florence, apostrophe answered Edith, taking the hand that embraced her neck, and looking into the eyes that looked into her so lovingly, as Florence knelt upon the ground before her. Why it is, I cannot tell you. It is neither for me to say, nor you to hear, but that it is, and that it must be, I know. Should I do it, if I did not? Apostrophe, are we to be estranged, mama? Apostrophe asked Florence, gazing at her like one frightened. Edith's silent lips formed yes. Apostrophe, Florence looked at her with increasing fear and wonder, until she could see her no more through the blinding tears that ran down her face. Florence, my life. Apostrophe said Edith, hurriedly, listen to me. I cannot bear to see this grief. Be calmer. You see that I am composed, and is it nothing to me? Apostrophe, she resumed her steady voice and manner as she said the latter words, and added presently. Not wholly estranged. Partially. And only that, in appearance, Florence, for in my own breast I am still the same to you, and ever will be. But what I do, is not done for myself. Apostrophe, is it for me, mama? Apostrophe asked Florence. It is enough, apostrophe said Edith, after a pause, to know what it is. Why, matters little. Dear Florence, it is better, it is necessary, it must be that our association should be less frequent. The confidence there has been between us must be broken off. Apostrophe, when? Apostrophe cried Florence. Oh, mama, when? Apostrophe, now, apostrophe said Edith. For all time to come? Apostrophe asked Florence. I do not say that, apostrophe answered Edith. I do not know that. Nor will I say that companionship between us is, at the best, an ill-assorted and unholy union, of which I might have known no good could come. My way here has been through paths that you will never tread, and my way henceforth may lie God knows I do not see it. Apostrophe, her voice died away into silence, and she sat, looking at Florence, and almost shrinking from her, with the same strange dread and wild avoidance that Florence had noticed once before. The same dark pride and rage succeeded, sweeping over her form and features like an angry chord across the strings of a wild harp. But no softness or humility ensued on that. She did not lay her head down now, and weep, and say that she had no hope but in Florence. She held it up, as if she were a beautiful Medusa, looking on him, face to face, to strike him dead. Yes, and she would have done it, if she had had the charm. Mama, apostrophe said Florence, anxiously, there is a change in you, in more than what you say to me, which alarms me. Let me stay with you a little. Apostrophe, no, apostrophe said Edith, no, dearest. I am best left alone now, and I do best to keep apart from you, of all else. Ask me no questions, but believe that what I am when I seem fickle, or capricious to you, I am not of my own will, or for myself. Believe, though we are stranger to each other than we have been, that I am unchanged to you within. Forgive me for having ever darkened your dark home. I am a shadow on it, I know well, and let us never speak of this again. Apostrophe, mama, apostrophe sobbed Florence, we are not to part. Apostrophe, we do this, that we may not part, apostrophe said Edith. Ask no more. Go, Florence. My love and my remorse go with you. Apostrophe, she embraced her, and dismissed her. And as Florence passed out of her room, Edith looked on the retiring figure, as if her good angel went out in that form, and left her to the haughty and indignant passions, that now claimed her for their own, and set their seal upon her brow. From that hour, Florence and she were, as they had been, no more. For days together, they would seldom meet, except at table, and when Mr. Dombey was present. Then Edith, imperious, inflexible, and silent, never looked at her. Whenever Mr. Carker was of the party, as he often was, during the progress of Mr. Dombey's recovery, and afterwards, Edith held herself more removed from her, and was more distant towards her, than at other times. Yet she and Florence never encountered, when there was no one by, but she would embrace her as affectionately as of old, though not with the same relenting of her proud aspect. And often, when she had been out late, she would steal up to Florence's room, as she had been used to do, in the dark, and whisper good night, apostrophe on her pillow. When unconscious, in her slumber, of such visits, Florence would sometimes awake, as from a dream of those words, softly spoken, and would seem to feel the touch of lips upon her face. But less and less often as the months went on. And now the void in Florence's own heart began again, indeed, to make a solitude around her. As the image of the father whom she loved, had insensibly become a mere abstraction, so Edith, following the fate of all the rest about whom her affections had entwined themselves, was fleeting, fading, growing paler in the distance, every day. Little by little, she receded from Florence, like the retiring ghost of what she had been. Little by little, the chasm between them widened and seemed deeper. Little by little, all the power of earnestness and tenderness she had shown, was frozen up in the bold angry hardihood with which she stood, upon the brink of a deep precipice unseen by Florence, daring to look down. There was but one consideration, to set against the heavy loss of Edith, and though it was slight comfort to her burdened heart, she tried to think it some relief. No longer divided between her affection and duty to the two, Florence could love both, and do no injustice to either. As shadows of her fond imagination, she could give them equal place in her own bosom, and wrong them with no doubts, so she tried to do. At times, and often too, wondering speculations. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.